Welcome to the Lifetime at Work podcast, episode 29. My name is Greg Martin, and I work at the prestigious investment bank Origin Merchant Partners, a team of experts in all things M&A, helping to sell companies, working on corporate strategy, and growing businesses through acquisition. My days are spent helping CEOs and business owners make good decisions, while I help manage a team of young professionals who work hard every day to support this. On the side, I record this podcast because the story of our jobs and how they affect us is important. Here we explore different jobs and different topics about the world of work with the goal of giving you more meaning, purpose, and love for your job. Each week I interview a different guest, and this week I am interviewing Stephen L. Blue, all about company culture in the workplace. My interview this week is with Stephen Blue. He's a speaker, he's written 5 books, is the CEO of his own company, and an internationally recognized business transformation expert. We talk a lot about company culture in this episode, and we do it in a number of ways. Where it goes really right, where it can go really wrong, what it all means. We also dive into the culture and the feeling of working a blue-collar job versus a white-collar one, because those are some of the different types of people that Stephen has worked with, and because he's a white-collar guy now, but came from that more blue-collar background. The biggest takeaway in the episode is probably about how to change or fix a bad company culture. And by this point, I feel like I've said the word culture quite enough, so I think it's time to start the interview. Here I am with Stephen Blue.
Well, hey, Steve. Welcome to the Lifetime at Work podcast.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Awesome. Well, I usually like to just start by giving my guests the chance to introduce themselves. So why don't you just give me a 2-minute background on yourself and we can dive in from there.
Sure. Well, I'm the CEO of an international company that makes life safety products. I'm also a professional speaker. I've spoken at the Harvard Business School, the United Nations, Carnegie Hall. I've kind of been around in the speaker circuit. I'm a best-selling author. I've written 5 books. One I co-authored with Jack Canfield. Some of your listeners may be familiar with him from the Chicken Soup with the Soul series.
Right.
I'm a film producer. I was one of the producers of a film of the life and times of a fellow by the name of Jay Abraham. Are you familiar with him?
Yeah.
You might be a little young, but Jay is arguably the most creative marketeer ever to live on the face of the planet. He I think it was Icy Hot, his marketing techniques put them from nothing to $100 million company. And he's done a lot of work with magazines. Entrepreneur Magazine was kind of a no nothing publication until Jay got involved. And I know Jay from a while back. I've used everything that he ever said. I've read every book he ever wrote. So when I had the chance to be one of the producers of his film, I kind of jumped all over that.
Yeah. The name's familiar for sure. So
He's been around. He's probably, you know, hotter in the 80s maybe than he is now, but he's still alive and kicking. And finally, I'm very heavily invested in universities. I was the first what they call CEO in residence at Winona State University Business School. And I'm a visiting professor on mostly international and business topics at St. Mary's University. So I get around the university circuit quite a bit.
So what do you, there's lots of things there. What do you focus on today mostly? Are you just a master of sort of juggling a bunch of different things?
You know, that's a good question. I get asked that often. You know, what is your, I just did a cover feature on Excellion magazine. And one of the questions they asked me was, what does one of your days look like? And what it looks like, Greg, is I kind of fade in and out of all of these roles, depending upon the demands at the moment. In the last couple of weeks, I was out in LA to receive an XP award for the speech I made at Carnegie Hall. At the same time, I was writing some blogs and articles for Industry Week magazine. And on the airplane, that's when I do all my writing. I've been working on my 6th book. And then, of course, you know, I do a lot of Zoom meetings for my business. Yesterday, I just had my board of directors here, and we had a business review and financial updates. And so I sort of go with the flow and try to pay attention to all aspects of my life when it needs to be. I mean, if you spend too much attention to one aspect of your life, something else is going to suffer. So I try to balance that out as kind of time dictates.
Yeah. And I know, yeah, it's hard sometimes to say for all of us, I feel like when we're juggling multiple things, what we, every day looks a little bit different, and that's what makes it kind of exciting time. So, that's great to hear. I'm curious about the speaking part of it. Where, you know, what are you typically speaking about? Why do people, have you do such large, you know, platforms, and what are you typically speaking about?
Well, it's always about leadership. It's often about culture, because I'm an expert in that. And it's often in terms of how do you change your marketing strategy and how do you improve the financial position of the company. So it's kind of, you know, top level executive kind of things. Every now and again, I did a keynote speech at the Delta Flight Museum a while back for the World Safe Foundation. That one happened to be about, you know, how you can continue your and maintain your efforts as a safety organization, how you get people pumped up and so forth. And every now and again, I'll do an on demand. I don't like to do on demand speeches or let's put it this way, custom speeches, because honestly, it's a lot of work. But I did do one recently for Medtronic, which is a global multi-billion dollar medical device manufacturer. They were having their safety week, and they wanted me to sort of illustrate for them how other companies have failed big time when they had safety missions. You know, as you can imagine, the medical device manufacturer, their processes have to be like fail safe. And theirs are, by the way, but they wanted me to give a speech about how other organizations that are well known lost their what they call culture of safety, and how Medtronic could avoid using theirs. And there was no shortage of examples: Boeing with the 737 MAX disaster, the NASA Challenger disaster, and Takata, which most people never heard of, used to be the largest airbag manufacturer in the world. They had a whole bunch of them go defective, killing a whole bunch of people. So in that particular case with Medtronic, I customized the speech to kind of fit in with what they wanted to achieve. And, you know, it's always better when you get somebody from the outside to tell people what you've been telling them all along in the inside.
Yeah.
So I get a lot of call for that.
So like from a culture perspective, it's not just the, hey, how do we make it fun at work every day? It's a lot of things about, hey, here's, as an organization, we need to value these things, and here's how we make that part of our organization generally.
No, that's exactly right, Greg. In fact, it's not so much now, but it used to be whenever I talked about culture, the CEOs in the room, their eyes would glaze over and they'd think I was talking about the free beer and pizza for lunch bunch.
Right.
And I'm not. I'm talking about a culture that by design. I often say most organizations have cultures by design, excuse me, by default and not by design. And I talk a lot about, you know, how do you create a culture by design, and why you should want to, because, you know, to create a culture for culture's sake that just makes people feel better. I'm sorry, but, you know, in a for-profit world, that needs to be directed toward profitability. And I show CEOs how to create that kind of a condition.
Okay. Yeah. I've got lots of questions on that as well. So maybe we'll dive into the culture thing in a bit here, but I then also wanted to talk about, just get on the table here, your background. I think I saw that you had done a lot of your schooling at night school, and yep, you know, didn't come as maybe as easily as it did for, or it does for people in certain situations. So maybe you just want to touch on sort of how you came to be someone who people now look up to and writes books and is able to give such speeches.
Well, you know, as you know, Greg, I grew up in a blue collar family, and my parents couldn't afford to send me to college. And this is back in, you know, the early 70s. I had no way to do it on my own. I joined the Navy and did 4 years in service of my country. And when I came out, you know, I had the GI Bill, which was helpful to some degree to get some of my college, but I never could really go back to school in earnest. And of course, this had to be night school because I was was working full time until a couple of years after I got out of the Navy. So I didn't get my bachelor's degree until I was 40 years old. And now we're dialing back 22 years, or actually 30 years now. There wasn't anything such as online learning where you could do it from the comfort of your home. You had to actually go into the classroom, and that would be, you know, 2 to 4 nights a week and a big homework load and so forth. And so I never got the, then I didn't get my, I'm trying to think when I got my master's degree. I got my master's degree in 2007 when I was, I don't know, 55-ish, something like that. And so all the while I'm doing all that, I'm working. And the good thing, Greg, about, in my view, working while you're going to school, particularly in a master's program, when you do a lot of papers and a lot of case studies, you bring some real world, real life experience to your educational experience. And when you write a paper, you need to do it in the way they want you to do it, but you sort of have some inside baseball instead of just what you've learned in the classroom. So I found that to be very helpful. But you know, I used to have a CFO that worked for me that did not have a degree. He was the smartest guy you'll ever know, the best CFO in the world. And I kept telling him, Joe, I kept telling you, you need to get your degree. It's not going to make you any smarter, but if somebody buys this company, they're not going to keep on a CFO that doesn't have a degree.
Yeah.
And you know, and whether we like it or not, and whether it's really useful or not, the society and certainly the business environment values the degree, and especially advanced degrees. I mean, you know, MBA is sort of like table stakes anymore.
I guess what's different between someone who kind of pursues a career in something sort of more blue collar versus white collar or more traditional sort of office? Is it something about, you know, the schooling, how you're raised, when you're, you know, what the outcome is? I'm curious. The culture that you're trying to go for in the place that you work, I'm curious as to the motivating factor for people.
Well, you know, I don't know anybody who, when they're 10 years old, said, I want to get a blue collar job. You know, it just sort of happens. People end up that way, whether by accident or by design. And the thing about these days, of course, you know, they're not most of the universities, a lot of the universities are starting to move away from just kind of like liberal arts or degrees that may or, you know, if you get a marketing degree, Greg, the woods are full of guys with marketing degrees. Mm-hmm. That's not going to distinguish you in and of itself. But now the universities, I know St. Mary's is one of them right here in town, they've started to move toward blue collar kind of degrees and blue collar education and training. You know, I was just over the university the other day, and they have a place called the Makerspace, and it's just a place where the kids can come in and sort of fiddle in a structured way. They've got 3D printers, you know, they got some carbon fiber printing machines, and the professor told me, he said, you know what, he said, these kids, and it's not an accredited course, but they get credit for the other courses they take if they go in there and produce things, you know, that are useful. And he said to me, you know what? He said, these kids don't even know the difference between a flathead and a Phillips head screwdriver. And he says, I tell them, you know, someday you're going to be a homeowner and you're going to have to use one of them. It'd be helpful if you knew which one was which. So anyway, universities are starting to recognize now that they need to have curriculums that are more focused, I'll call it real work that you can get and make real money with. I mean, heck, truck drivers now are making, I don't know, $100,000 a year. Plumbers have always been you know, high paying trade. Welders, by the way, most people think welders are like anybody can do it. You really can't. I mean, I've had welders in my operation before. That's a very highly sensitive and highly distinctive skill that you have to really know what you're doing. And, you know, you can't find enough of them, so you pay whatever you have to pay for them. So, you know, I think there's a mix between, there needs to be a mix between sort of blue collar and white collar. Some people really don't want to think that much when they're on the job. And I'm not knocking it. Yeah. I'm not criticizing it. But, you know, some people just want to check their brains in at the door. And that they can go work for somebody else, by the way. I don't encourage that, and our culture doesn't reinforce that. But some people prefer that. So, you know, for them, they ought to be in that blue collar situation. in my situation, jobs were not that easy when I got out of the service. They were very, very hard. And I didn't like the options that I had before me. My father was a truck driver. My mother was a waitress. I don't know why, Greg, but for some reason I said, nah, I just don't see me doing that. So there must be a better way. There must be another way. And one of the pivotal things that sort of launched me and changed my view and reinforced me along the way was you're familiar with Tony Robbins.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I've read everything he's ever written. I've bought everything he's ever sold. I've done the fire walk with him 4 times. And I was scared to death each time. I've taken the people that work for me that voluntarily wanted to do on fire walks for team building and so forth. And after you sort of getting immersed in Tony's philosophy of life and business, Tony's philosophy generally, I would sum it up in a nutshell, is decide what you want, go after it, throw everything you can possibly put toward it. If you got a carpet bomb and send 15 F-15 fighters in with you, go make it big. Don't do it halfway. And so ever since then, I've been a maniac on if I have an objective or I have a goal, I attack it with everything I can think of. And that was pivotal, I think, in changing my mind or solidifying in my mind where I wanted to go. And then some of it was luck. I ended up working for what is now called Rockwell International. In the 70s, it was called Allen Bradley Industrial Automation at that time. And I was lucky to land, and I was a first line supervisor there. And I was lucky to land that job because I learned from the best of the best. Allen Bradley in those days was known as the greatest people leaders in the planet. And so I was immersed at a young age in my industrial career on the right way to treat people and the wrong way not to. And that stood me instead for a lot of years. And then I just sort of, I'd look at a position above me in the organization. I'd say, I want to be that. I'd figure out how, because they're the ones that call in the shots. And then I'd get in that. And after a while, I'd say, well, I want to be that. Because they're calling the shots, and I sort of built my way up from there. But one thing I would say, and I know this is one of your questions, to people, I wrote a blog the other day, I think for CEO World, where I said, you should build a career the hard way and why you should want to, something like that. And I basically said, what you have to do, what I did, is I took all the crummiest assignments you could possibly find at every company, at Allen Bradley, and I said, anything people wouldn't touch. I'd move anywhere they wanted me to move. I take all the toxic nuclear assignments that no one wanted anything to do with because it wasn't sexy and, was contaminated with all kinds of ways to go wrong. And I'd go fix them. And then I'd go fix another one. And then pretty soon the senior leaders, the general managers of almost every business would say, I want Steve Blue to come here and fix that. And so I would. And it was tough. It was really, really, really tough. Some crummy assignments and hole in the wall places. But one thing I learned, many things I learned from that, Greg, is I know everything about an organization from the bottom up to the left, to the right. There isn't anything that I tell CEOs all the time, you haven't seen a problem I haven't already solved. And you don't have a problem I can't already solve for you because I've kind of been all. So that was the best thing for me, was to understand an organization from the top down. Some CEOs sort of skip all of that, and they get in their a leadership position. They don't understand there's something going wrong in their organization, and they can't figure out what, because they haven't been there. And I'll give you a perfect example. Most airline CEOs are guilty of that.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I think you're trying to use that thing that you have, which is, hey, I've done. You have little advantages potentially in a world like this or in a corporate world like that. But when you can take advantage of various positions that you've had on the way up and having seen them, you can actually become a lot more effective because you know what it's like.
Yeah, that's right. And behavior is behavior. And so I don't care what organization you have. I know how people behave at the bottom, and I know how people behave at the top, and I know how people behave in the middle. And, in a sense, the operational issue or opportunity is kind of inconsequential because people have always behaved the way they have always behaved. And that hasn't changed much over time. And it certainly hasn't changed much in an organization. So, oh, yeah, now I know you have the millennials and you have the, what do they call it? The quiet quitters.
Yeah.
I wrote a blog the other day about quiet quitters. That's not a new phenomenon. But it got a name. That's why the media has been chasing after it. Quiet quitting has been going on for decades and decades and decades. And I've told people in the blog, the problem, you know, you don't need 17 things to do to solve the quiet quitting problem. You only need to do one thing, and that's treat people with respect. And my evidence of that is because, one, I do it myself, and it's one of our core values in my company. But 4 or 5 years ago, Harvard University did a study about what are the motivators and the satisfiers and dissatisfiers. They polled 20,000 people, and they found that the number one thing people wanted the most was respect. They wanted that more than money. They wanted it more than recognition. And so a lot of these trends that are sort of miraculously appearing in the workplace now, like quiet quitting, they've been around for a long time. They just never named them before.
Yeah. One of the things, just to go back on the point around the, call it, you know, blue collar service, or and then kind of the typical office computer job, is I have a bit of background in the food area of food and in the restaurants. And it was interesting to see in the pandemic, there were just all these people in the service industry, whether it be chefs or servers. And, you know, a lot of them had also wanted to go back to school, I think, right? Like they were just, they didn't really want to be in the food industry, and especially in the way that it was for their whole lives. But yeah, there wasn't really a rationale or a reason or something to push them to go ahead and do that until they had this pandemic happen, where all of a sudden they said, well, there's no job here. I might as well go back to school. I might as well try to get a job in this field or that field and shift out of it. And I think there was a huge, and it was interesting for me to see that, you know, working with some of these people, seeing that they had a ton of great, say, call it chef skills or service skills or whatever, but then trying to figure out, okay, how do I use those skills to get me in another type of job that's actually going to be paying me during the pandemic and in this new world, but really wanting to kind of leave it. So I thought, anyways, that it, thinking through what you were saying a little bit and sort of taking those tough jobs and transitioning those to something else, I think that you know, part of this rationale, and as we hear about, people talk about the great resignation, and you know, hey, there's not enough employees and all that. There's certainly a transition going on here of people trying to make some sort of shift.
Well, there is. And, you know, you raise a good example out of the hospitality industry. But let's take a waiter as an example. That person, if he has, he or she, if they have terrific interpersonal skills, and there's been a lot of studies done on this, the waiters that smile more than those that don't get better tips than those that don't smile that much. And when you think about what they have to do, they have to juggle between the kitchen and satisfying them and the customer and satisfying them, because the waiter knows if the kitchen is late, they're not going to take it out on the chef. They're going to take it out on him. And you think about those are transferable skills to anybody would want somebody working for them that has that kind of a skill set.
Yeah. Or even just the fact that they're talking to people all day.
Right,
as a server. I mean, that's a great skill. A lot of jobs, you're sitting behind a computer and maybe, or, you know, you're on calls, but you're not the one talking, and you're just never developing that part. I mean, part of the reason for me starting a podcast in the first place was to develop, you know, more talking skills and to be able to record myself and listen back and see, you know, it's a great skill to have. As you, I mean, I ask you as a speaker, how did you, or how do you think about, you know, speaking in front of a large audience and being good at that and developing that skill?
You know, I get asked that a lot. Somewhere the other day, and I was asked, I think the comment was, I bet you don't get scared when you're speaking. I said, I get scared all the time when I'm speaking until I utter the first sentence. I mean, when I'm before I, you know, I spend a lot of time, and this is just a staple in the speaking industry, Greg. For every 1 minute of speaking, you're going to work on take about an hour for every 1 minute by the time you know, do it, revise it, practice it, and all that kind of stuff. So if you got a 45-minute speech, you're going to put in 45 to 50 hours in that. Well, that's the easy part. There's all kinds of people that teach that, you know, the skill of developing a speech. And then when you do it, you have to have some you have to have some difference between structure and not structure. If people think you're reading lines like a robot, they'll tune out and won't listen to you. So you have to be, to some degree, extemporaneous, but you can't ramble. You have to have structure and order. And I tell people all the time, I get nervous before every single speech. And the more I've practiced the speech before I give it, the less nervous I am. But I'm still nervous before. But when you step on the stage, as long as you know exactly what you're going to say first and exactly what you're going to say, how you're going to end it at the end, then all of that anxiety, it goes away from the minute you start speaking. And that's been my experience. And always nervous in the beginning, but once I get going, you know, I hate it. I was given a speech in New York City a couple of weeks ago, and they were filming it, and the film crew had some problems. I don't know what it was. And so I was supposed to be on like at 9 o'clock or something, and I never got on till like 9:45. And that 45 minutes was like in an eternity to me, because it gives you too much time to go over what can go wrong. What are you going to say? What if I don't say that? And so I tell people all the time, so you need to get up there and do it. The more you do it, the less afraid of it you'll be.
Yeah. And you don't have, and practice is really the only way you're going to get good at it. And you don't have to start at Carnegie Hall, but if you ever want to get there, you do have to start somewhere and practice. That's the way to do it.
In fact, when I look at some, cause I've recorded almost every speech I've ever made, and I have a professional speaking coach that I asked to critique every speech that I make, which is painful. But I look back at the first ones, like when I was doing them at the Kiwanis Club, they're horrible. They're just absolutely horrible. And then I look at the later ones at, you know, United Nations, and they're spectacular. And so your point is well taken. You got to get out there and you got to practice it and practice it and practice it and practice it and hone and refine your skills. But you got to do it in front of an audience. Sitting around in your room doing it isn't going to help much.
Yeah, totally. Okay, I want to shift a little bit to the jobs thing, and I think the point that you made before was that employees, effectively people in a job, are just looking for respect in a lot of ways. That's kind of the simplest way to put it, and all at the same time seems so simple. What do we want out of our jobs? I don't know if that's a very broad question, but is there a central thing that people are typically looking at? I mean, there's obviously the paycheck, but from a culture perspective, there's obviously more. Is there commonality there? Is there, or how would you sort of frame answering that?
Yeah. let me look back to respect for a minute. It's not enough. Everybody wants their supervisor to respect them, right? That's not enough. That's table stakes. Everybody has to respect everybody else that they interact with in the organization, because it's suboptimal if you don't. I'll give you an example. One company that I took over, the people in the factory were using such vile language against each other. It was horrible. It was an absolute snake pit. And I've often said when I give speeches and when I write books that you can't have a good team if they don't respect each other. And so the behavior is rooted in their language. Assuming they're not punching each other out, their behavior is rooted in their language. And if they speak ill of each other, there's no way they could be a team. So I said, so it's not enough that the supervisor wasn't respecting them out there. It was, they weren't respecting each other. And there's only one way to get that, especially if you walk into a snake pit like that. I called everybody together and an all employee meeting. And I said, you know what? This language has got to go. I said that's just intolerable. If you use that language against each other, the very first time you lose it, you're going to get fired. This is zero tolerance. You can't say, okay, blank, 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 blank. Okay, we'll let you do it two or three times. And like, you can't be a progressive, so-called progressive discipline thing. So I said, look, guys, I'm not talking about damn. I'm not talking about hell. And you know who you are. You're all like this to each other. And I said, I just won't have that. And so within 2 hours, I had to fire my first person. Within about an hour later, I had to fire another one. By the end of the week, I'd fired like 8 or 10 people. And I wondered if I'd have any workforce left by the end of the month until they finally got it. And then, of course, we were weeding the people out that were the worst offenders. And then the other people are looking at, well, because you'll always get tested, Greg, when you make a declaration as a leader, you know that. Yeah. And so be ready for it. Because if you don't back it up, it won't have any impact. And then people started looking at that. So, well, maybe this is kind of like the way we ought to do. And then as we, of course, backfilled from people, we're very, very, very picky about the kind of person that we let in. And over time, it took about a year, we'd flushed all of the non-respecters out and replaced them all with people who respected each other. We make that a job requirement, by the way. We don't just say, yeah, rah, 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 respect each other. If you caught disrespecting somebody, you won't last long here. And so that was, I think, the most important part. Now, when you go to what people want, it's just the same. It's been the same over time. People want to be appreciated. They want to contribute something that's meaningful to them, that they can brag about to their neighbors and their friends, and they want to be respected. And of course, they want to be paid a fair amount of money, and most people want to make more than they're making now. So, but honestly, when people walk in and they say, I don't care about anything else, I just want to make sure I'm making X dollars an hour, that is an unfulfilled employee. And no amount of culturing up that anybody could do will make them a fulfilled employee. They are what they are. When people get to us that have worked for, places that treated them badly and that they didn't like their job, didn't like their boss, didn't like anything, by the time they're 40 years old, it's too late to change them. Yeah. And we don't even try. If they come in, we have a very sophisticated interview process. When they come into our factory for an interview, frontline employees they work with will be the interviewers. Yeah, the leader of that team will interview as well. But then they tell us that guy doesn't fit in here, or it wouldn't fit in here. Because by the time they get to, their 40th year or 30th year, I don't know, pick a number, they've been so infected and contaminated by bad bosses and bad behaviors and bad organizations that it's impossible to turn them around. I had a guy once in a company I took over. He was the head union shop guy, steward, I guess they call it. And he hated, been working for the company for 20 years, should have been fired 19 before, hated the company, hated everything, probably hated his wife and his life, and couldn't wait to get to the bowling alley after work. And I took him under my wing, and I invested a lot of time and effort in him. And I even brought him out on a road trip to see one of our customers in the area that he worked in and one of our suppliers. And I thought, this is going to be my greatest success story, because I'm going to show him, I'm not a bad guy. The world isn't a bad place. And no matter what I did, nothing worked. I still ended up firing the guy.
So how about progress, though? Like, do people need to be moving forward, or are there certain people that, want promotions, want to move up, other people that are not? And what motivates maybe those people that there's no obvious progression or next level that they're trying to get out of their job?
Yeah, some people just don't want it. They don't want a promotion. They don't want responsibility more than they have. I'm not knocking that. I mean, that's fine. They don't want more effort. They don't want more complexity. And so they're just, in our particular case, out in our factory, just use that as an example. We have two levels of people. I don't remember what they're called now. The one level is like, you can do your job and that's pretty good, but we don't let them stay at that level. We tell them when we hire them, you're going to have to move in X period of time up to the super guy level, whatever they're called out there. I don't know what it is. And we'll give you all the training and all the coaching and all the support to get there. But if you don't get there in X amount of time, because we really need people performing at a high level, then we're going to ask you to leave the company. Note, Greg, that they didn't do anything wrong. It's just that there's a certain expectation that the organization has. But if you tell them up front, it wouldn't be fair to bring them in and say, oh, by the way, did I mention that you're going to get fired if you don't get here? But if you tell them up front then they can choose. And some people choose. They say, thank you, but this is probably not for me. Most people say, yeah, that's a clear path to get to kind of the top job. And we shower them with all kinds of recognition and reward when they get there, because probably, and I take up full page ads in the newspaper with their faces on it. People just love to see themselves in the paper and brag to their neighbors. So there's a certain subset of person that wants to do that. And every organization has limits, Greg, in terms of how much you can grow. A classic case is, and I've seen this many times in my career, as a company grows, most people can't keep up with the demands of their position. Let's say you're a plant manager, let's say you're a marketing manager, and you're working for a company that's 80 million, pick a number. And then over the course of developments and whatnot, it grows to be a $500 million company. Well, yeah. The demands and expectations at 80 are a whole lot different than 500. And most times people can't grow with that. It's just the way it is. And so, most organizations, if not all of them, have upper limits based on what the capacity of the organization is and your personal capacity. And people tend to be comfortable with that. The key is you have to find out. The worst thing you can have, Greg, is somebody who can't afford to quit but hates you. You have to find people like that, and you have to, you know, you be kind about it. You give them severance, you know, assuming they're not violating policy and whatnot. And you just, you have to ask them to leave because they're an infection on the organization. Their attitude affects everybody around them, and it's sort of like a leech.
So if we were to take, though, an organization that didn't have, you know, where there wasn't, you mentioned, having to fire a bunch of people because it was such a terrible, culture. But what if it was something, you know, not so bad in a situation where you are trying to make an improvement in the culture? Is it something where you can, like, assess and ask your employees what they think or you know, maybe throw it back to you in terms of how would you go about, you know, improving a culture in some way or another on something that, you know, isn't completely broken, isn't completely crazy, but is one where you're trying to, you know, get more out of your people. You're trying to beat a competitor who you've been struggling with for a while. How, is there ways to do that?
Yeah, it's a multifaceted problem or opportunity. Let me start with the fundamentals. First, you have to assess the kind of culture that you have. You have to understand what that is. And you don't do that by asking the bosses, because they wouldn't have a clue. They probably wouldn't have a clue. They think they do, but they probably don't. So what I've done is I actually survey the employees. You know, tell us what the culture is like around here. You have to put a little more structure in it than that, Greg, because most people say, what's culture? So you say, you know, what kind of values? You get it down to its fundamental. What kind of what's valued in this company? Is it honesty? Is it integrity? Is it respect? Is it with this? Whatever it is. So then you have to find out where you are. And you might find out where you are is not bad. Not all cultures that are not understood are bad. It's just that they're not sub-optimized because they were not well understood. And so then you got to get to your senior leaders, each level of those, and you have to ask them their views. And then you show them how divergent their reviews are from the rank and file. And that's usually an illuminating experience for them. Oh my God, I didn't really know that they felt that no one was respected here or whatever. So then at the corporate level, because this can't be done anywhere else, you have to decide and declare remember everything that the culture is starts with values. What values do you want in this organization? And what are you willing to do to see to it that that happens? And it's different from every organization. I know what mine are. We call ours the seven values of ingenuity. In fact, I have a keynote speech about that. I know what mine are. Some values are kind of universal, like integrity. You have to have integrity, right? Respect. You all have to have respect. So one of our core values happens to be community. My people go out all the time. They build habitat houses. They fix older people's homes, mow their grass, all on company time. So that's just one of mine. That might not be one of yours. And then so you have to figure out what values do you want. And then you have to do two things. Communicate what they are. Say this is now going to be our corporate values. And people will think, yeah, fine. Sure thing. That's, you know, I heard something about this last week. It'll go away if I ignore it. So then the second thing you have to do is once it's well understood, is you have to reinforce it. And how do you reinforce it? Well, with incentives, with pay structures, with recognition, and with firing at some point in time if people don't want to participate in those values. So that's a slower process, but it works. It works effectively. It takes a number of years. I've had many a consultant in to help us understand that. I have an industrial psychologist that consults with us all the time. I have a creativity expert that consults with us all the time. So it's a slow process, and it's an okay. It's better to do it slow than have a fire sale. If you have to have a fire sale, you're in so much trouble already, you might not get out of it. And while you're fussing with all this culture stuff, Greg, and changing the values around, you still got to make a living.
Exactly. You can't kill the business while you're doing it.
Right.
I'm curious what you think about it taking you out of your main zone, but the tech world, kind of the startup world, the environments that they're creating. I mean, it seems like, you know, ping pong tables everywhere. You've got whatever you want, dogs in the office. Yep. You've got just a completely different way of operating than I think we've ever done. Do you have any perspectives on what that is like for culture? What that means? Is that a signal of something about us? What is that?
Well, my son works for a company like that.
Yeah, okay.
It's a little more than a startup. They're a logistics tracking company headquartered out of Austin. And the two guys started 5 or 6 years ago. And last year they exceeded $1 billion. That's $1 billion with a B in sales. And they're not a public company. They haven't gone for outside funding.
Yeah.
So these guys are doing something right.
Right.
In anybody's world. But anyway, they have all that. They get free massages on Friday afternoon. They have a place in the company cafeteria where they can drink beer and, you know, play video games and all that kind of, because this is the values of this crowd are going to be totally different. The values they have are going to be totally different than what it would be in an older line manufacturing company. And the values of the owners or the leaders, these guys are all the same, Greg. When I visit my son out there and I have dinner with him and his bosses, they're all talking, you know, a foreign language, and they all understand what they're saying before they even say it. And so no doubt the owners of that business and the leaders of that business decided that there were certain things that their company was going to value and they'd be worth paying for. One of them is, of course, you know, the comfort and convenience of things that you wouldn't get working for another company, the massages, the, you know, the, whatever they are, free haircuts. And so it's an entirely, again, my values and your values and a startup value is going to be completely different because they're all completely different people. But whatever these guys decided on, and I never asked my son, what's the culture like that? What's it like there? But the owners, whatever they decided on what their values were and what they're willing to pay for, reinforce, communicate, recognize, and so forth, that's worked pretty well for them.
Yeah, no.
If I wanted a company like that, I wouldn't want to change anything in the culture.
No, I mean, I stake it really just on the fact that they're trying to retain really high quality talent, and your competition is doing that as well, right?
Yeah.
Someone decided, hey, if we had a ping pong table in here, it's going to be looked at great. People, employees are going to love it. They're going to tell everyone, hey, we have a ping pong table. It's great. And then you're just, okay, that's table stakes. You now have to have a ping pong table, and it just kind of goes and goes and goes from there. And you end up creating that type of culture and environment around work. Now, I don't know how, you know, certain organizations, I'm sure it's more of a faux pas to get up and play ping pong all day versus doing your job. You still have to do it. But, you know, having that there, I think, is just a signal that there's more to the job and the organization than just the bottom line, getting the work done, which I think is you know, a signal more than anything. And in some cases, you know, the cost isn't crazy. You've heard these things about, you know, unlimited vacation, and it's not like everyone's on vacation for 50 weeks the year.
Right.
You know, just,
yep.
It's just a perk to, you know, make people, I think, feel like they are, even what you were talking about, respected and valued and someone that is prized in the organization and a good company. So I mean, you know, if you can afford to do it, sure. And if it's just part of, I think, how they consider the quest for talent and retaining the best. So,
well, you know, you just look at what replacement costs are.
Yeah.
You know, something north of 50 to 75 for sure. And then it doesn't even include opportunity costs. You touched on a good thought when you said unlimited vacation. My son, where he works, they have unlimited personal time,
okay.
Paid personal time. And I remember my mother, when she was alive, rest her soul, she was old school, grew up during the Depression. She goes, oh, no, you shouldn't do anything like that. We have the same thing here, by the way. Shouldn't do anything like that because people be gone all the time.
Yeah.
And I said, Mom, I said, if that's the case, I got the wrong people.
Yeah.
When people try to impose strict rules and regulations on people because they can't be trusted to do the right thing, you need to get different people. It's as simple as that. I have a place in my factory, by the way, called Creation Station. The employees named it. I call it a Google-like space in the middle of a factory. It's where people can, it's a high-tech kind of space with you know, lounge chairs, a pool table, not a ping pong table. And people can come back there anytime they want to ideate on things and without anybody telling them what to do. If people were back there screwing off all the time, I obviously have the wrong people. But because we have the right people and we trust them, if you trust people, they'll act trustworthy. If you don't trust them, they'll act untrustworthy.
Yeah, exactly. Totally agree. It's about the people you want. So I was going to ask you another question just about interacting with your subordinates, people that are working for you and that dynamic. Do you think that they can, that can be a relationship that is a genuine, can there be a genuine relationship there? Does it have this layer on it that you just can't get rid of because, you know, you can't be friends because of the hierarchy in an organization? Or how do you sort of feel about that?
Well, I think my son's example again, I think him and his boss and his boss's boss are all friends. They hang out together and all that. That's a totally different environment. To be so-called friends with your subordinates, in my view, kind of compromises your judgment because now I'm sort of doing something to a friend as opposed to an employee. Having said that, though, my direct reports and I, they've all worked for me for better than 15 years. And we're very close. I mean, we know what each other's thinking. We know what each other's going to do. We have a complete confidence. And when my CFO's daughter's having a graduation, I go, of course, you know, those kind of things. We don't hang out together. I mean, a lot. I mean, he'll come to my Christmas party every year. And if he's throwing a bash, you know, I'll probably go over there. But in the context of kind of friends, I think that can be awkward. I remember one time I had this guy work for me. He was my vice president of international. I can't remember what gave rise to the question by one of my directors, because we were sort of hanging out as friends, if you will. And one of my directors said, "What's it going to feel like if you have to fire it?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "I can't imagine a situation like that." And he said, "Well, okay, fine." A couple of years later, I had to fire him. There was compelling circumstances surrounding it, and it was really difficult because he was a friend of mine. And then you have to ask the question as a leader, did I wait too long on that because we were friends? And on the flip side, Greg, the question to ask if you want to be friendly with your subordinates is, I'm sorry to put it this way, but what are you going to get out of that? You may get more productivity. You may get more loyalty. You may get more whatever. I don't know. But you have to ask the question as a person responsible for the bottom line, how is this going to impact the bottom line?
Yeah, well, you were talking about respect. And so I, you know, sometimes I think about that and just in that context, right, where you're saying, well, I respect you. You know, in theory, you're a good person. We should, you know, be friendly and talk and be friends. And though at the same time, I kind of agree with you that I don't think that always works. But it's just one of those things that I, you know, I'm actually as someone who, you know, I manage probably 20-ish people today and trying to figure out, you know, what exactly my relationship is with some of those people. I like them, but I can't necessarily get best friends with them. It doesn't really work. It's a different type of relationship, even though we know each other well, like you're saying.
That's why it's so hard, Greg, for someone who gets promoted from one level to the next. And then all of a sudden, the nine guys that were his peers are now his subordinates. That's why it's always hard. The hardest thing for somebody in that role is to be able to, God, we're friends. What happened?
Right.
We're not friends. That's very, very difficult. I honestly, in my career, Greg, I don't know if I only know a few people who are able to successfully navigate that.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I think that being said, I think, you know, having a good relationship with your coworkers is critical to enjoying your job. I think that could really, you know, make or break a situation. But at the same time, it's a function of, who are those people that sort of make it for you? And just the relationship that you have, it's really, I think, probably the better relationships have to be someone who's probably on a similar level to you. And, not to say that you can't have commonalities and other different relationships with call it subordinates, but at the same time, first and foremost, your kind of professional relationship probably needs to be there first and be the focus. So
So, yeah, it does. It does.
Maybe one last question for you is like just on your goals in, as you think about the next kind of whatever 5 years or the coming years of your career.
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm working on my sixth book. It's titled Crossroads of Catastrophe. And I can't remember what the subtitle was, something about how great companies lose their way and how you can not have it happen to you. Whether I actually finish that will depend on how commercially valuable I think it ends up being. You know, if it's another good to great, everybody, that's all, you know, saturated out. but anyway, that's one of my goals. And I somebody asked me the other day, how do you find, I wish I could, wow, you've written five books. I wish I could find the time for that. And I say the same thing. I say, you can't. You just have to stop doing something else.
Yeah.
And I said, it's not that hard. I said, you approach the book writing. If you do a deal with a publisher, Greg, you probably know this, you'll be contractually obligated to give them 50 to 75,000 words in the book, depending on, you know, what genre and all that. And you'll have a deadline that you have to meet in order to satisfy the editor or the publisher. So, okay. So I've done a couple of deals with big publishing companies and a couple of the rest of them I did self-publishing. But I tell people now, every time I approach a book, whether I'm going to do it with a big publisher or not, I set myself a budget. I'm going to write 1,000 words a day. And then I, you know, in 60 days, okay, maybe 75, plus I didn't do it on Christmas and I missed a Sunday or whatever. In about 75 days, because I add on another 15,000 for my editor who will, you know, chop it to pieces and incise it and all that, I'll be done with the book in 75 days. And I said, so that's how you do it. You have to approach it as a work product and a requirement that has to be done. Otherwise you won't ever finish it. So that, anyway, that's my goal for in the next couple of years. The other thing is we have this flagship product that we introduced a few years back, totally different than anything we've ever done before. It's called Zone Guard. It's a product that saves lives in the rail industry. People are getting run down out there all the time that shouldn't. And this absolutely saves people's lives. And so my main mission in life now is to save every life I can and not have one person be tragically killed on the track that that doesn't need to be because they lack my product.
Awesome. Okay. Well, I appreciate you, your time today. And it was great chatting with you. Is there something, I don't know, if one of your books you want to plug that you think would be particularly, or if people are just looking to learn more about you, where should they go?
Yeah. The best thing is to go to my personal website, which is stevenlblue.com, stevenlblue.com. And that'll link you to my company website and my speaking engagements and my bio and anything you want to know about me.
Awesome. Okay. Well, thanks a lot. I'll also link to that in my website in the show notes. And with that, thanks a lot for joining me today, Steve.
Great. Thanks. Pleasure talking to you, Greg.
Well, thank you so much for listening. I hope that after this episode, you go back and you think about your company culture and what it means for you. Maybe even if you have an influence or if someone asks in the near future how you could improve it. That's always something that I think we as organizations should always strive to do is, hey, how can we make things better? It's not like you're going to change things overnight, but, you know, steps in the right direction and knowing where you want to go. If you enjoy listening, please let your friends know about the podcast. That'd be really appreciated. You can also leave a review on Apple iTunes or really wherever you are listening to this podcast. And until then, don't worry, be happy.